linoleum knife.
Now, why did you not ever play that when you were doing the whole Playmate of the Apes recap last year?
I forgot I had that on a cassette.
Ah. What was that?
First, we're going to be professionals and announce what we are. We are Linoleum Knife. We are a podcast.
About movies.
Yes. And we are the hosts of it. I'm Dave White of the Weather Underground, and you are Alonzo Duralde of the me generation, the Pepsi generation.
If you're going to do these jokes, you really should maybe think about them a little before.
I only think about myself.
Yes, well, I have no response to that. You are Dave White, film critic for movies.com, and I am Alonzo Duralde, film critic for therap.com and What the Flick.
Anyway, okay, so the song, I had this, I'm staring at the wall. Well, it's not a full wall, but I'm staring at the stacks of cassettes that sit happily on the little counter between our dining room and our kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And I'm looking at them thinking, what, it's my week to pick the music. What will I pick? And I thought, I have the perfect song in mind. I have this this weird New Zealand band called The Renderers, and it's on one of those cassettes somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They do this creepy, slow song called I Hear the Devil Calling Me.
Uh-huh.
Not noisy or anything, just
disturbing.
Like cowboy junkies, if they were super actually junkies.
Okay.
Which is a very good thing to be. I couldn't find it. When I say I couldn't find it, it's because
you didn't look.
No. If you've been to our house, you will see. There's a whole lot of cassettes on that wall. Stacks. There's a good half dozen very tall stacks of cassettes. And it would take a long time, like over an hour, to go through all of them.
Well, then maybe you shouldn't have waited until 2 minutes before the show.
And then I thought about this other
thing. And then I
thought
about this other thing. If you cared about your work.
Because Danny Boyle put out Trance this week, I thought I'm going to play something like...
Trancy.
And then I was like, no.
So you failed, basically.
So that was The Mummies. The name of the band is The Mummies. The song is called You Must Fight to Live on the Planet of the Apes.
I figured it would be.
And that is how I feel about this podcast.
Well, there you go.
You Must Fight to Live...
On Linoleum.
On Linoleum.
Well,
or someone will talk over you and insult you.
Yeah, indeed you will. Speaking of theme music, we've had yet another entry in the we never really asked, but I guess maybe now we have, listener-generated theme music. This one comes from our good friend Dynamoxy. Check it out.
Linoleum knife.
Everybody's free.
Remix Dave into
Everybody's free.
Podcast about movies.
Everybody's free.
Go ahead and rob a bank.
Everybody's free.
Even remix me.
Thank you for that. I have a surprise for you.
What's that?
Well, we have a special guest today. It's Rosala of Everybody's Free to Feel Good fame. She's here and she's pissed off.
It's funny. That song always makes you think
Come
of
on in, Rosala.
That song always makes me think of the season 2 opener of the Venture Brothers.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's always my first association now. It didn't used to be.
No.
Back in the early 90s, you couldn't escape that song.
Thank you.
Dynamoxy for that. Everybody can stop doing this now.
See, I knew you were going to regret last week throwing down the gauntlet. I knew it.
No, it's awesome. I what's funny to me is that it's one bit that everyone loves the most, and it's just me saying the name of the show. So I don't know what that means. Yeah. Now, if you want to do it where, like, our voices are sort of, like, pitched up and sped down and, you know, dropped on the beat, you know, in rhythm to the beat.
Now you're getting picky.
Yeah, if you want to.
Thank goodness there's no audio of you doing your karaoke version of Can't Get You Out of My Head.
I'll do it right now. A cappella.
No.
I can. I'll
That's, yeah. That's too much fodder.
People,
don't do it.
People
don't.
Will love me for that.
Oh, I beg you.
Kylie Minogue's Can't Get You Out of My Head is my karaoke jam. Mm. I know. I lay it down.
When I put it to rest.
Especially when you get to the high parts.
You lay it down and drain its bodily fluids and replace them with formaldehyde.
The set me, when she goes, set me free. Like, I don't know where I pull this from, because normally I can't get up that high. Uh-huh. But when it's karaoke time, I can hit that high note.
Are you dumb?
I did. You don't remember. I dig deep into the most BG portion of my soul. You were there.
I know.
You were there both times.
I just don't remember you hitting the high note.
I'm very good at Kylie Minogue's Can't Get You Out of My Head. Very good.
Okay.
Yeah. Just letting y'all know that I'm very good at it. So, movies that we have to talk about.
Well, first, I want to talk about the passing of Roger Ebert this week.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, I think for just about
any... Because it's all about you.
No,
kidding. That look on your face, like, I'm offended suddenly. Keep going.
I think for just about any professional film critic our age was to some extent inspired by him. I'm not saying you had to, you know, necessarily agree with him all the time, but I think that his presence, you know, his unique place in the media for film critics, you know, really kind of, I mean, for me, I know it was sort of, you know, I probably had read movie reviews before that, but seeing him and Gene Siskel on television was sort of like, oh, okay, so this is a real job. This is a thing that I could conceivably do for a living.
And that is where he failed.
Yeah, the for a living part might be stretching it. But
because he made people think that that was an actual job that people made money doing.
But yeah, you know, so I... It was very sad when he
it was very sad
because you know I
was, it was sudden.
Well,
like
I mean,
it was very sudden because he was like, "Yo, yeah, I've got cancer again, but it's gonna be fine, and I'm gonna do this and that."
Yeah, and I've got all these projects coming.
24 hours later, boom.
Bam! Yeah, no, it was crazy. But you know, I mean, I was thinking about it because you know I do that Critic Wire survey every week, and this week Matt asks, you know, what is your favorite piece of you know critical writing by Roger Ebert? It's like, God, I don't know. I mean, this guy's been, he was reviewing movies all, for almost as long as I've been alive and has been on TV for almost as long as I could form complete sentences. So, you know, it's hard to sort of pick a thing, you know.
I experienced him less as a written critic than as a TV critic. And my first exposure to him, well, obviously, was television because I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. But I would get the books, the Movie Home Companion books.
No, I never did.
In fact, I have an autographed one floating around here somewhere.
I actually didn't begin reading film critics until college.
Hmm.
I didn't read them through high school. I didn't read film critics.
Oh, see, I was...
I didn't read movie reviews.
I was already... One of the times that we... that, you know, we had the... You know, at school, they always make you sell magazine subscriptions.
Yes.
I remember making my parents take The New Yorker for like a good 2 or 3 years just so I could read Pauline Kael.
How old were you?
Like 14.
Yeah.
But I was already like reading the collections of her stuff.
I would read movie reviews in magazines like in the school library,
mm-hmm.
but not, I didn't go hunt it down.
Did you ever have the Maltin book?
No.
Oh, see, I always said that too.
I had the Golden Turkey Awards.
Well, yes. That's a whole nother conversation. Yes.
But the, which connection.
I know. Harry's now our boss at movies.com.
Yeah, Harry Medved.
That's so Harry great. Medved, I never get over
who
that.
Who co-wrote the Rotten Turkey, the Golden Turkeys book, is my big boss at movies.com. And when we met and he introduced himself to me, I was like, Medved? Harry Medved. You're Harry Medved. And he was like, yes. And I was like, all right, I don't want to make you feel old or anything, but when I was a kid, Golden Turkey Awards was the book I read and read and read and read and read. Because I wanted to see all those crazy movies.
Yeah, no, that totally molded me.
I come to realize that he himself was basically a kid.
Yeah, he was 18 when he did the 50 worst films of all time.
He was his late 20s. Teens, early 20s, and I was 12, 13. Yeah. So he's not that much older. He's not that much older than me. Yeah. But, you know, experientially, a whole world away, you know, because I was landlocked in a little town. It's another reason I didn't have access to as much film criticism as you did.
Sure.
Because I was in a tiny little town.
There was not an internet yet.
In southeastern New Mexico, and you were in a big city.
True.
Like, you had a revival house.
Yes.
You could demand that your mother drive across town and take you to see Citizen Kane when you were 11 years old.
True.
That's not what was happening in my town.
And what was cool also was when I was watching Siskel and Ebert, once I hit a certain age, like in my early teens, I was able to go see these movies they were talking about. And I probably wouldn't have had they not. So, you know, I remember going with my older brother Fernando to go see Diva. I remember seeing, you know, My Dinner with Andre several times.
Yeah. Those films did not come to where I lived.
I'll go ahead and do my DVD recommendation this week is Starstruck, which is a movie that I would not have heard of originally had it not been for Roger Ebert, and that wound up becoming one of my favorite movies ever. So it's a new wave musical from the director of My Brilliant Career, which if you've never seen, it's a hoot. But anyway, Ebert was hugely influential to me, you know, as I was a kid and realizing that this was something that I wanted to do. I mean, I would say second only to, again, Fernando coming home from college with all these books about, you know, the golden age of Hollywood, was Roger Ebert, was seeing him and Gene Siskel on TV every week. And then, you know, cut to 1995, and I got to meet him. I was running the USA Film Festival. It was my first year there. You know, there was a lot riding on it. I was under pressure. It was very nerve-wracking, and I was kind of terrified of the whole thing. And he and his wife, Chaz, came, and they just were so great and supportive, and he had lots of really good advice for me and was really complimentary about the curating and just was great. They were always lovely. And I would run into them at festivals and, you know, say hi. And I just saw Chaz like a month ago at the Independent Spirit Awards, and you know, I never think people like that are going to remember me between times, you know, like I always feel like I got to go to them first and remind them who I am. She like charged right up to me and she was like, Alonzo. And I was like, Chaz. and I was standing next to Christy Lemire, which is the weird thing because, you know, obviously she knows Christy way better. And I guess my enormous bulk was hiding her. So I kind of stepped aside and she was like, ah, and then she and Christy talked, you know. So my condolences to Chaz Ebert, who is an exceptional person and has seen Roger through a really difficult, you know, last decade or so with him, you know, losing his ability to speak. But again, even that, I think he faced his illness so, I mean, you know, people say heroically, which is, I don't even know what that means half the time, but he just with good humor, you know, I think that's the important thing. Like he was never morose about it, or at least not publicly. He was very cool, kept going. I mean, worked probably more, I think, after he got sick. Losing his speaking voice really made him rely on his writing more.
Yep.
And for a guy who was so ensconced, I mean, this is a newspaper, like, you know, bourbon in the drawer newspaper guy. Not that he had it, although he did famously go through AA and talked about it.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, he talked about it on, like, Howard Stern and stuff.
He dated Oprah.
He dated Oprah once. but like, he, you know, he came up through like old school, you know, journalism, you know, newspaper journalism. And he was super all over the web, like tweeted, blogged, you know, the whole thing, was not afraid of it, was not like, these kids, like totally plunged into it. I think expanded his audience even further.
Yeah.
So just in so many ways, I think a real role model. And you know, I mean, you know, yes, what Siskel and Ebert did, you know, they they did sort of begin the whole process of turning film criticism into a binary of, you know, yes or no, rotten or fresh, thumbs up or thumbs down. But somebody was going to do that anyway, I'm sure.
Television did that.
Yeah.
They just were the guys.
Well, other critics on television were probably doing star ratings or whatever, you know.
Yeah, but the same thing.
But it was the chemistry that the two of them had, I think, that really made them take off, whereas a lot of other film critics on TV have never, you know, captured that again. You know, and I've already seen some kind of snotty responses to the gushing obituaries from people from people of his generation. It's kind of like, well, you know, sorry, but for those of us who were, you know, who read him when we were young and who grew up with him as a presence in the culture, you know, he mattered.
I do have a DVD recommendation because you picked yours. The very first foreign language film that they talked about on
At the movies or sneak previews?
What was it first called?
Sneak previews was the PBS one.
Sneak previews.
Yeah.
It was sneak previews. The very first foreign language film that they talked about that I remembered and that I actually had the opportunity to see on HBO when my family finally got cable was Bertrand Blier's Get Out Your Handkerchiefs.
Oh, yeah. I love that movie.
Yeah. I don't even know if it's on DVD. It probably is.
I think we'll look.
But yeah. I knew that movies were made in other countries. Like, I wasn't an idiot. I mean, I was kind of an idiot.
Let's not get crazy here.
But I didn't know that I would ever get to see them because those were just things that happened in
big cities.
New York and Boston and Los Angeles. You know, like, they did not happen in Roswell.
Right.
They did not happen in Hobbs, New Mexico. That was not a thing. And so so I relied on those guys telling me that they existed and then HBO to show them.
Now, did HBO show Get Out Your Handkerchiefs subtitled or dubbed?
I don't remember.
Because I remember I saw that movie the summer between my junior and senior year of high school and thought it was amazing. And then it was coming on the Playboy Channel.
That's right.
So I asked a friend of my dad's who got the Playboy Channel to tape it for me, but it was like the dubbed version. And so they just thought it was some crappy like softcore movie. And why was I wanting to see it? And I'm no, you're missing the, forget it. But I love that movie too. So anyway, Roger, you were awesome. We'll miss you.
It was a great honor.
Oh, yes.
To be yelled at by him.
In print.
He didn't yell at me in person. But he called me out by name to scold me publicly by name.
For the high crime of
hating Crash. And it wasn't, I mean, I wasn't the only person to hate Crash. There were a lot of critics that hated Crash.
Yeah.
But I think what offended him was that I was mocking it.
Right.
I was mocking it. I mocked Oprah while mocking it. And they were buddies.
Yeah.
Because they just, like, they went on that date once, but they stayed friends.
Right.
And, I didn't just say it was a bad movie. I peed all over it.
Yes.
And in a goofy ha-ha-ha-ha kind of way. And I think that was what really bothered him.
What did he call you? Glib?
Glib and smug and something else, but it was great. Like I remember thinking, first of all, I was excited because I was like, he hates me. And then secondly, I was sort of like, Roger Ebert took time to be angry at me. I just felt honored by it. I think he's right. And it never made me angry at him.
No.
It never made me think, oh, what a jerk. It made me think, wow, Roger Ebert. Why me? I'm nobody. Like, that was the other thing. I was also a little confused.
Yeah.
Because I thought, it was like that time that when Michael Tekins contacted me about being in the Penguin anthology, and I was like, well, certainly you're thinking of another Dave White. Like, you don't need me to be in your fancy book that's coming out from a major publisher. You need the other three Dave Whites who are also writers. they are out there.
Right.
Like, it's such a generic name that there are actually published authors with my name. But the I was confused. I was thinking, why is he picking on me? Because I'm just a dummy. Like, I'm nobody out here. But he didn't, I don't think he made distinctions. I think, like, he saw film critics on reputable, on legitimate websites.
Right.
You know, people who were clearly, that was their job. And he just, you know, I don't think he felt that hierarchy. I mean, obviously he did, because he was the boss of everybody. But I think when you are the boss of everybody, you see everyone else below you as being on the same level, you know.
Perhaps.
Maybe. Anyway, he yelled at me once.
Yay! Yay. But he was awesome. There will never be anybody who has, there will never be another film critic who has his impact on the culture.
So that's what you say.
No, there will not. Although, yeah, well, it's funny, Adam,
dude, we're gonna run things.
Our friend Adam Berry wrote a
real
piece
soon
for BuzzFeed about, you know, the death of Roger Ebert and the future of film criticism. And
that's
I,
us.
I jokingly commented, "Well, the future of film criticism is the linoleum knife."
That's correct.
No, but in the same way that no talk show host will ever again have the impact of Johnny Carson, just because the media landscape is so different, I don't think any film critic is going to have the impact of Roger Ebert anymore. Not even us.
You say that now.
But just you wait.
We're already both fat, so that's...
I did.
We're halfway there.
I did go as him for Halloween one year. Clark went as
How did you do that? What year was this?
1985.
Okay, I've seen pictures of you from 1985, and you were skinny. What did you pad yourself?
I might have. I can't remember.
Because he was a big dude all through that time.
I've always felt fat, so, you know, that was part of the costume. But no, my friend Clark went as Gene Siskel.
People can't see your feelings.
But I can eat them.
I've seen those pictures of you from then, and you were a trim. Mm-hmm. You were a regular sized person. You're fat now. You real fat now.
Well, ask Kurt Holman about why he coined the phrase "trundle his hulkish form."
Well, okay, Kurt Holman weighs 63 pounds,
soaking wet.
So
now,
hello, Kurt Holman. We know you're listening. All right, we gotta start talking about movies.
Yes, okay, yes.
We have a scholar. We have an arts scholarship. We a child's future is in our hands today. As soon as we're done with this, we have to go help judge an arts scholarship.
Yes, which a friend of ours maintains in her late father's memory.
Yeah. So anyway, we gotta get talking about movies.
Okay. Evil Dead.
I like it.
Why don't you explain, since you're the horror guy, and you actually watched the whole thing without hiding behind your press notes, unlike me.
Five kids go to a cabin in the woods. One of them, Jane Levy, who's on the show Suburgatory. Is that show still on the air?
Yeah.
Oh, so Happy Endings is being canceled, but Suburgatory gets to live. Great.
Although the ratings for Happy Endings were up this week.
Seven extra people tuned in. She's a junkie. They take her to the woods. To their family's spacious summer home in the woods.
Right.
It's this decrepit
shack
that's been used. It's been turned into a satanic murder hut. And, you know, things in the basement and gross. And, so they're going to help her kick heroin there in the cleanest, safest, calmest environment possible.
It's her idea.
And then the Necronomicon, and they open it, and the Lou Taylor Pucci incants the names, and the, like, you know, Mordor, or whatever they're called, you know. And
Flim Flam.
Yeah, and then the demons zoom, you know, to the cabin.
Steadicam!
The rape trees come, and the demons happen, and everyone starts, you know, you will die. You will all die tonight. I will devour your soul.
Yeah. So, it's the same thing as the first Evil Dead, except there's a reason for them to be in the cabin. A reason that sort of gets tossed aside. They don't extend the heroin addiction
metaphor,
demon possession analogy, you know, as strongly as they could.
Yeah, it's more sort of a setup of why they don't immediately think something is wrong.
And post Cabin in the Woods, this version of the Evil Dead exists in a world where Cabin in the Woods never was made. Unless you look at the opening scene that sort of explains to you what is happening in this house when the kids aren't around. That's a little meta because, you know, the girl is being attacked by the, you know, hillbilly redneck slaughter family, and you know, which is a thing from Cabin in the Woods.
Right.
But also because it's a thing from Cabin in the Woods, because it's a thing from other horror movies.
Exactly, yeah.
So, so there is that, but it's very straightforward. It doesn't have the intentional humor,
right,
of the original Evil Dead. Even though Diablo Cody apparently took a pass at the script, whatever she did to it, they erased.
That's what I'm hearing.
She wrote it in pencil, and someone else came along with a big eraser. Yeah,
but Sam Raimi, you know, and Bruce Campbell are the executive producers. So I mean, it's not like this is a remake that was snatched away
from No, exactly.
They were involved.
It's their baby.
Yeah, Fede Alvarez.
You stay until the end of the credits and you'll see exactly how much it's their baby.
Right.
So it's an unnecessary remake. It is in a long line of unnecessary remakes. Having said that, I thoroughly enjoyed myself.
Yeah.
I was not scared, but if that's... And I know that is technically the litmus of horror. You must be scared. Not me. It's good if you scare me, but don't count on scaring me because I'm jaded. If you scare me, it's because you tap into my own personal fears. It's the reason why the first Paranormal Activity movie got to me because, and I've said this before, what's down the dark hall?
Right.
What is coming for me down the dark hall while I'm sleeping? It's why The Crappy Strangers got to me.
Yes.
You know, who's...
That should have been the title, actually, The Crappy Strangers.
Who's breaking into my house in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
Supernatural stuff does not scare me. And I think it's very hard post-Exorcist, really, for supernatural things to elicit scares.
I think there's a specific... There are a couple of specific things that creep me out that this movie touches on. Gooey stuff getting in your mouth.
That's gore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And doing terrible things to your own body with a sharp object.
Saw.
So yeah, there's a lot of both of those things in this movie, and both of them made me go,
So if that frightens you, then, yeah, you're going to be scared. Now, I was not scared, but I was, again, thoroughly satisfied because there's tons and tons and tons and tons of gore. Yeah. And it builds. It's like nonstop chaos of nasty stuff. Building to a genuine crescendo that I found visually really beautiful. And I won't give away what happens, but there's shots during the final moments that are extravagantly bloody and really gorgeously shot.
No, I agree.
And so I'm really into it.
My only caveat for this movie is that...
Besides that it is a cynical cash grab, what?
Well, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't like movies where they set up a very specific set of rules and guidelines and then toss them out the window because they don't want to actually fulfill the dread promise they have made.
Yes.
And this movie does that.
Yeah, it does. It backtracks from its own rules. But again, if it had not done that, we wouldn't have gotten some of the really cool stuff that happens at the end.
No, actually, I think we could have. It just would have... I think, like, one of the things about this being a post-Cabin in the Woods movie is that I thought that, like that movie... Anything goes.
Here's the other thing.
You know, but it's like, But clearly, no, they want to have an Evil Dead 2 of
the If field. They have played, if they had played by their rules.
Uh-huh.
I think this counts, what I'm about to say counts as a spoiler, so you might turn it down for 10 seconds while I say.
Okay.
If they had played by their rules, we would have been given another Ash. Okay, now, don't comment on what I just said.
No, I'm not going to.
And,
I don't know that I agree, but okay.
Well, yes, because then I'll say what I'm going to talk around this. The thing that I just said would have happened if they had played by their own rules also wasn't supported by what came up to that point. Because that is a strong element of the entire series. And they would have needed to really build that up a lot more strongly to make it happen.
See, I don't agree with you, but I don't know how to talk about it without giving things away. So we'll take this off the air. well, when the DVD comes out, we'll get into the spoiler aspect of it. But yeah, we liked it. So you know, I actually have still never seen the original The Evil Dead. I've seen Evil Dead 2, which I liked a lot. So, yeah, but it was, you know.
Totally enjoyable, unless you're looking for something really...
groundbreaking.
Yeah, and it can't be. It cannot be. And that is because it's an unnecessary remake.
Right, which 99% of all remakes are.
Well, they all are.
Well, I mean, unless you're remaking a bad movie and improving upon it, which people don't do nearly enough.
Or unless you're involving yourself in some sort of art project. You know, like if you're Michael Haneke, why did he make an American version of Funny Games? We don't really know why.
It's I think somebody hired him to do it.
Shot for shot kind of thing.
I think that was... That was his.
Why did Gus Van Sant do Psycho? Okay,
can I answer one of these questions before you ask the new ones?
I'm being rhetorical, but sure, go ahead. Gus Van Sant, with your little answers.
Gus Van Sant did Psycho. That was an art project.
Yeah,
that was like he was doing a cover. I think Michael Haneke doing a shot for shot remake of his own movie in English was the equivalent of, is it The Replacements that did an entire video that's just a close up of the speaker?
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, you want an American version of this movie? I'm going to give you the American version, which is this movie, but with American actors in English.
Right.
Bam.
Yeah.
Well, and British and Australian, but whatever.
Yeah.
Moving on. The company you keep.
I gave this film a bad review on movies.com. And wish I could give it a worse one. Like, as I move away from this film, I hate it even more.
Wow.
Because I really feel like the people who made it didn't think. I don't know what the book is about.
Right.
I don't know how thoughtful the book is.
Right.
But this is a thoughtless movie.
It does. For a movie that is ostensibly
about.
You
tell them what it's about.
That is ostensibly about, you know, ideas, it does seem kind of slapdash. So Robert Redford stars as a lawyer in upstate New York, and Susan Sarandon is a suburban housewife who is captured by the FBI, and it turns out that she was a former member of the Weather Underground, which was the violent offshoot of the Students for a Democratic Society in the late 60s, who rejected the premise of nonviolent resistance and blew stuff up.
We are not violent.
Exactly. So Shia LaBeouf, the reporter for a paper in Albany, starts sniffing around and eventually realizes that Redford is in fact also a member of the Weather Underground who's been hiding in plain sight for decades.
Yep.
So now Redford's on the run to find his other Weather Underground collaborator, Julie Christie, who can clear his name. And LaBeouf is on the story, and he encounters a bunch of people, including Brendan Gleeson as a police chief who knows more than he initially lets on, and his adopted daughter, Britt Marling, who also gets wrapped up in the story, and his FBI contact is an old college friend played by Anna Kendrick, and Sam Elliott's in it, and Stanley Tucci. There's a really good cast in this movie, and there are interesting things they could have done, like it could have been a character study of Redford's character, or even of LaBeouf's character, you know. It could have been about the ethics of dissent, and, you know, is violence, you know, justifiable when it's about stopping a war, you know. It could have just been a good old, like, Redford-y political thriller, like 3 Days of the Condor. But it's not any of those things. It's just kind of this mishmash, and when people finally do get together to have conversations and you think they're going to be about something, they're not. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of very generic speechifying about, you know, principles and journalism and privacy and secrets and the past and the system, man, and
bleh. Okay, so here's what I hate. This movie takes Shia LaBeouf, or as I like to call him in this film, Specs LaBeouf. Cub reporter.
Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah. You almost get the feeling that he's the bad guy by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Robert Redford holds the Shia LaBeouf character in such disdain and scolds him enough times that you're like, I'm sorry, wait a second. You and your crew murdered people.
Yeah. Also, Redford, you were in All the President's Men, so shut up.
That's not the point. The point is, you and your pals killed innocent people.
Right.
You killed innocent people.
Or innocent person in this room.
No.
One bank guard.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay, well, in real life, it was three.
Right, but in the movie, it's just one.
Okay, well, anyway, you killed somebody.
Right.
You killed an innocent person who was just doing his job. But the journalist is the problem? You know, like if they're nice journalists, they don't come after you? Is that the point?
Yeah, they're never clear about why that's a thing, why there needs to be so many hectoring speeches to Shia LaBeouf's character when he's just exposing the truth. It's right. Not like, you know, and oh, you're going to ruin a lot of lives, blah, blah. I was like, well,
you did too.
I'm just getting the information and sharing it with the public.
He's not ruining anything. Y'all ruined, the life of all the people who loved the person that you murdered. And you ruined your own lives by being chicken
and
running.
Yeah.
If you had your principles together, you'd have been like, yes, I killed this person in the name of blah, 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 blah. You would have been all Muslim terrorist about it and said, yes, I claim responsibility for this death that I've just committed. Instead, everyone in the movie goes off and lives in the suburbs and then gets upset when everything comes crumbling down. F you and all the horses you rode in on. The film would like you to empathize with these old radicals. I'm sorry, murderers. These old murderers. So, yeah. If the movie were thoughtful about that and really made it seem like these people, you know, had made some really, really hard choices, then perhaps I would not despise it so much. But the more I walk away from it, the more I do. This is an apology, you know, for what? Nothing.
Well, yeah, and again, I think even the movie isn't even addressing those issues enough to have a point of view at all. I don't even know that they're necessarily wanting us to root for them. But I don't know what they do want us to think, because it's not, they aren't saying anything about it. It doesn't have any kind of a point of view. It doesn't allow people to sort of argue two cogent, you know, trains of thought that, you know, we have to leave deciding which one we think makes sense. Everybody is such a cardboard cutout in this movie, and the conversations are so sort of just blandly generic about whatever they're having confrontations about. There's no meat to tear apart here.
My other complaint is that Bob Redford and Julie Christie do not dance to Ain't Too Proud to Beg.
They do go to Ann Arbor at one point,
though. Furthermore.
Which made me really, and that's when it really clicked for me that everybody in this movie is way too old to be playing a former 60s radical. Like, I mean, yes, the actual Weather Underground bank robbery happened in 1981. But, you know, Robert Redford was in his 30s when Nixon was elected.
Yes.
So he was not, like, you know, burning his draft card. He'd already aged out of the draft.
Right. These were, like, almost middle-aged people by the time this stuff was going
on. Yes.
Yeah. Furthermore, both he and Julie Christie, and I don't have any information about the truth of this, but they both appear to have had help with their faces.
Mm, yes.
I mean, I think it's fairly visible on camera that both he and she have indulged in some upkeep on their face.
Right. Pardon our dust.
What hardcore leftist, radical, off the grid, screw the system, my values are superior. What person does that?
Maybe the guy who provides them with, like, passports and credit cards under fake names also does a little, you know, little tuck.
Look, it would need to be a face-off situation.
A little injection in the forehead.
It would need to be a face-off situation. For that to be a real reason why they would do it.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I'm looking at these people talking about, you know, fight the power, and I'm like, fight the Botox, really. How about you do that? Let's start there, and then you can come tell me how to live.
Your personal face is political.
Yeah. But, stupid movie.
By the way, I just want to say,
hate this movie.
I just want to say that terrorists of all stripes generally tend to take credit for their actions, and there are terrorists of all stripes existing in the world today, not just Muslims, Dave White.
Listen, the most famous of the recent terrorists have been Muslim terrorists.
Well, okay.
There have been American, obviously, yes. American terrorists who've done terrible things too.
I'm more afraid of the George Tiller people.
The ones who run around yelling, "We did it," are the Al-Qaedas.
Well, okay, fair enough. I just wanted to be clear on that point.
I'm very aware.
You want to get any listener mail?
I know. No, I don't think Muslims are terrorists.
Okay.
I just think that the Muslim terrorists are the ones who have the best, like, branding campaign going on. They've done the biggest ones. They've done the most extravagant ones in the past, oh, say, 12 years. And, yeah.
But they are not alone.
No, obviously they are not alone.
Fine.
This message has been brought to you by the Equal Fairness of Terrorism campaign.
Thank you.
Sponsored by Linoleum Knife.
Danny Boyle's Trance.
Start talking the plot. You okay, tell the plot. I'm gonna.
Okay, so James McAvoy works in an art auction house, and just as he's explaining to us how you're supposed to respond in a robbery happens. But we find out that things don't go exactly to plan because rather than hide the painting in the safe the way he's supposed to, something else happens. And next thing you know, he's been hit in the head and he can't remember anything that's been going on. But that's a problem because he's the only one who knows where the painting is. So mobster Vincent Cassell hires hypnotherapist Rosario Dawson to crack the locks of James McAvoy's head and figure out where this painting is. And things get super crazy from that point. And what I love about this movie is that it is so effective at being a movie with twists and with gotchas and with misdirects and all that stuff, which lately I've gotten kind of tired of in movies. Like, so many movies do it so badly that it was refreshing to see a movie that really knows how to do it right. And it's slick and it's gorgeous, and, you know, it's Danny Boyle, you know, and shot by Anthony Dodd Mantle. So everything, there's like red and blue lights on everything for no real reason, but it looks great. And everybody looks awesome, and people get naked, and there's violence, and it's. I know, I'm super articulate.
Thank you. Thank you, Roger Ebert. I have a problem.
Uh-huh.
I have a Danny Boyle problem. My Danny Boyle problem is that I'm in the tank for Danny Boyle. Like, I realize, I guess I knew this already, but I've been forced to look at myself very deeply this week. I don't feel like this movie is bad. I think it's actually really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I would know if there was a bad Danny Boyle movie. I think I may have crossed over into an always uncritical stance with his films because
I think you like all the movies that you've seen. It's not the same thing.
He knows what my reptile brain wants and he gives it to me.
Mm-hmm.
It is always 1993 with Danny Boyle. Like, it is 20 years ago and everybody still is free to feel good. Like, yeah. Okay, you quit.
Sorry.
All right. And I don't know that I have a good reason other than that sort of like extremely showy stylishness,
uh-huh.
And it's aggressive in a very sort of like "f you" kind of way. It's a cheap kind of aggression because it's this giddy kind of hopped up, you know, violent but stylish, you know, thing.
But think of how much better he does it than Guy Ritchie.
I like Guy Ritchie too.
I know, but
and kind of for the same reason.
But Boyle does it better, I think.
All right, sure, but I like them both, and it's sort of for similar reasons. I have a soft spot for that, for everything that is Trainspotting and After and Shallow Grave, all like that hyper color and energy and action and motion.
Well, you need to see Millions.
It's whooshing and, you know, I know, I still
haven't seen it. It's a little mellower, but it does have those touches.
You know? There's something so precisely cool about him, and it's a calculated kind of cool, but I'm so into it. I am so crazy into it. And I've gone back and looked at reviews that I've written of his films, and I have to stop this because I realize now that I'm doing it, I always compare his films to a rave. Seriously, Sunshine, this, like, I've always compared his movies to like really ecstatic sort of raves.
Uh-huh.
And that's because I really feel that he is trying to give you that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he, something about that world got into him, and he's going to spend the rest of his life trying to give it to you in a movie.
Right.
I
mean, even 127 hours. Like,
and I haven't,
When you're stuck in the cave with the guy, but his sort of fantasy imagination stuff is all that kind of like.
Is trippy. Yeah. And so I'm not going to say a word about the plot of this because it's A, real convoluted and involves people lying nonstop. And involves often the camera lying to you sometimes, too. Or at least not giving you the full amount of information you need.
Right,
and so
that's kind of why I'm inarticulate about this movie, is because I can't talk about
it. We can't talk about it.
I will say, it's a movie that I want to see again, now that I know what happens.
Right.
To see all the clues that are seeded along the way.
Yes. Here's the other thing. And this is like a 1-2 punch. It wouldn't even have to have been directed by Danny Boyle and have the energy it has. It's got Rosario Dawson in it. And I'm actually in love with her. Like, I don't know of any other word to describe it. Everything about her makes me happy. And it has from the minute I saw her in Kids to now.
Yeah.
It's this combination of her beauty, first of all. She's super beautiful in this unusual way.
Right.
And she has, I describe in my review, her voice is its own chill out room. Like, she has this really calm, soothing kind of voice.
And she's playing
a hypnotherapist in this film. But I tell you what it is. What really put me over for her was Comic-Con. several years back. She hosted a panel at Comic-Con a few years back where she was creating her own comic book. Mm-hmm. Because she is a big comic book fan and has been since childhood. And she talked all about it during the panel. Like her grandmother, like it was this very sort of like woman thing in her family. Like her grandmother loved comic books and taught her mother to love comic books and they passed it down to her. Like this strange, you know, feminist sort of comic book collective in her
matriarchy
life. Yeah. And someone at the panel, I may have told the story on this show before, someone at the panel stood up and asked her if she'd played the bootleg video game where the people from Sin City fight the people from Rent and that her characters can fight each other. And she got this wide-eyed look on her face and she said, I have to play this game right now. And I thought, you're the coolest person alive. She's got a really, really thick charm about her. I'm super into her.
I spent the first third to half
of this. I don't get this way about actors either, really. I mean, occasionally, like I know I've talked about Rachel Weisz and how I'm into her too. Something about a very specific type of woman in film that I just am like...
Clashy broad.
You're so great. You know,
I spent the first third to half of this movie thinking, wow, is this the first bad Rosario Dawson performance I've seen? Why is she so weirdly cut off? And like, is this her idea of what playing like a smart, cool, professional woman is? And then I realized that was all part of the scam that this movie is playing on me. And then I was like, oh, you win, Rosario Dawson.
Yeah.
You got me.
She always wins.
She always wins.
Yeah, I haven't really examined what it is that I feel for certain actresses. Mm-hmm. It's not a diva thing.
No.
And it's not a worship thing either. And it's not sexual, obviously. I mean, appreciate
a strong black woman.
Kind of it is, I guess, maybe sexual because there's an element to it. I mean, when I think of them, I think of them as how beautiful they are.
Right.
But then I'm gay, so that doesn't jibe, you know. So I'll figure this out eventually.
Think on it. But
I love Rosario Dawson so much.
For people who care about this sort of thing, you get to see all of Rosario Dawson in this movie.
Oh yeah, by the way,
and most of James McAvoy and Vincent Cassell.
You do get the full Rosario Dawson. Yeah.
And it's a plot point.
It is a plot point. There's a reason that it happens. But she shows up like a Botticelli. Like there's not there's a it's and it's an art themed film, so that reference makes sense.
And James McAvoy is kind of sneaking up on me, you know? Like, he never...
I dig him.
He hasn't had any sort of big, showy, like, Ewan McGregor kind of breakout role. Mm-hmm. But just over the years, you know, Narnia and Wanted and X-Men First Class, I'm like, hey, you got the goods, McAvoy.
I know, I do like him a lot. Yeah. And I think he's really good in this film.
Mm-hmm.
As a very slippery sort of person that you don't think... You think you know what's going on with him, and then you find out, you really don't know what's going on with him at all.
He spends the movie trying to figure himself out, and you're doing that too.
Yeah.
You know? And Cassell, who starts out as like, you think, sort of typical cliched, two-dimensional bad guy, and he kind of goes off in interesting directions as well. I feel bad that I don't have the writers in front of me, because really, this is a terrific script. This is a, you know, a Chinese puzzle box, if you will.
It's also turning into a love it or hate it.
Really?
Kind of thing. I've been reading the critics who don't like it. They really don't like it.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, they hate it.
There's been a lot of hate for
Evil Dead.
Evil Dead.
Yeah. So a lot of hate for Evil Dead. A lot of hate for Trance. We love both of them.
Yeah. Hang on, I'm looking up the Trance writers because I want to give them a shout out. Writers don't get enough credit. Joe Ahern and John Hodge.
Right.
Well done, gentlemen.
One of them wrote Shallow Grave.
Oh, wow. Okay, so they go way back with
Oil.
All right.
Yeah.
Room 237.
I think The Shining is about cake. The end.
And if you look hard enough, I'm sure you'll find the clues that that Stanley Kubrick was going to clearly watch making a movie
about. I'm going to watch it 100 times in a row, The Shining, and then I'm going to explain to you why it is all about cake.
Room 237, which is it's open theatrically, but it's also on iTunes, and anybody can see it. It is a documentary about fanatics of the Stanley Kubrick film The Shining, who have determined after countless viewings that they have decided what Kubrick really meant with the film. You just thought it was a horror movie based on a Stephen King novel, but no, it's really about the genocide of the Native Americans, or the Holocaust, or about how Kubrick faked the moon landing, or the legend of the Minotaur. Take your pick.
I believe all of those things. Here's what I want. I want this movie, I want all the different opinions of this movie to be true at the same time.
I don't think any artist, I don't know, I'm not going to say that, but I don't think that Kubrick, I don't know what I think.
It doesn't matter what you think.
I think that, like anything else, any Rorschach blot that you stare at long enough, you can start imbuing your own meanings into it. And so for that phenomenon alone, I think, yes, this is an interesting movie, and it's just other people's obsessions can be kind of entertaining. I would have loved it as like a half-hour DVD extra, I think, as a feature film. By the end of it, you're like, okay, enough already.
No, I'm really into this movie because it's not so much about whether or not these people are right. It's about mania.
Yeah.
It's about obsession, and it's about mania. And I love how the director structures the movie and builds up the momentum of sort of insanity. You know, by the end of the movie, you're thinking, okay, I think everyone is crazy.
Although you don't ever see these people. And you never see them. You don't get to look in their crazy eyes.
All of their opinions weigh exactly the same. And you either have to sort of kind of half believe them or assume that they are all nuts. And I just love the idea that people could, you know, hone in so deeply on one thing and decide with plenty of visual evidence, I might add. You know, like there's support for all of their, if you're into numerology and into, you know, the idea that if you're into the idea that Kubrick is so meticulous that every element of every frame is intentional, then yes. Well, then everything that these people think could be true, because the film is utilized in the movie in ways like slowed down, sped up, shot frame by frame, shown in reverse.
Yeah. I don't believe conspiracy theorists when they think that the world works in a way that everything is that clockwork.
Yeah.
And I don't even believe it when they say that about the films of Stanley Kubrick, as notoriously picky and, you know, fussy and anal as he was about everything.
Yeah.
You know, like his assistant gave this really great interview to the New York Times, basically saying like, no. The kid wears an Apollo 11 sweater because the costume designer had one.
Right.
Well, not because it's his symbol that he was faking the moon landing, right. You know.
But I want it to be true. I want this to be real. Like, I want my favorite line.
I want to believe.
My favorite explanation of the film is that after Barry Lyndon, he was bored. He was bored with regular filmmaking and then chose to make a puzzle box. And this movie is the puzzle box. And it's going to take decades to solve it. I love that idea. And I want that to be real. It's probably not. But I want it to be real. And so as a film about that kind of mania, this is great to watch. It is a really entertaining and kind of eerie and creepy film to watch if you give yourself to these loons telling you their stories.
No, it is. It is kind
totally
of
entertaining.
It does get weird. It feels like you're getting to the recesses of a mind you didn't want to be in. You know.
Yeah.
I think it kind of makes its point, and then it keeps making its point over and over again. So, but it's worth seeing, and especially if you're like a movie nerd at all, and especially if you're a Kubrick nerd. You know.
Speaking of minds you don't want to be in.
Yes.
Six Souls.
Yeah.
There is a movie that came out this week. It's called Six Souls, the number six Souls. It is probably not playing at a theater near you. It is in limited release. However, it is available on demand. You can, anybody anywhere with the internet and the TV can see Six Souls. You will, however, be one of the last people in the world to see Six Souls, as it is a film that was made in 2008 or 9, released theatrically for the very first time in April of 2010 in Japan, and then slow rollout across the entire globe. It opened in Kazakhstan. You laugh, but that is not a joke.
No, I believe you.
It opened in Kazakhstan in April of 2011. It opened in Spain in June of 2012. It opened... It already had its
Estonian run, right?
A DVD release in Finland 27 months ago. Now it's here. An American movie shot in America, I think, starring Julianne Moore and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Julianne Moore is a forensic psychiatrist. I'm a forensic film critic.
Which means what?
I'm going to make forensic lunch when I'm done here for our forensic lazy Sunday.
I thought you were making gay lunch.
No, that's for someone else.
Oh, okay.
I had an argument with an anti-gay person online this week, and I told him off with, I'm going to go make my gay lunch. The story that does not need to be told. Anyway, she's a forensic psychiatrist. And Jonathan Rhys-Meyers has multiple personalities. And she's like, oh, poo-poo, that does not exist. And then the multiple personalities come on Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and leads her on a wild chase of, you know, what's going on with Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. And it turns out that there's a phantom sound wave...
Okay.
That's been inhabiting souls for a long time, beginning with like a...
Is it like the brown note?
Faith healer? Yeah, kind of. Here's the greatest thing about it. This sound wave is identical to the one on the Joy Division Unknown Pleasures album. This is because that poster is in the movie in a moment when they discover the sound wave. And they see it on a computer. The sound wave, and it's a demon, and it goes in you with the ear through your ears or your face. I don't know. And then,
so does the Joy Division guy the devil?
Then the maybe it could be Ian Curtis in the form of a sound wave.
There we go,
inhabiting the souls. But anyway, there's some satanic hillbilly grandmothers and some people being bent like spoons and. There's old-timey faith healers. Did I say that already?
Maybe, I don't know. I kind of tuned out.
Albino children and people with mucus coming out of their eyes. And,
oh, good.
A sort of Necronomicon sort of style graffiti that's everywhere. And Julianne Moore going from empty house to empty house, finding clues that don't make any sense and...
Okay, better or worse than the Julianne Moore movie with Samuel Jackson where her child is missing?
Oh. just about as...
That level?
That level of stupid and weird and senseless.
Ah.
I will say that this should be seen in a double feature with Tyler Perry's Temptation, Confessions of a Marriage Counselor. Because
why?
Both of them exist in this bizarre spiritual economy where, you know, in Tyler Perry's movie, you get the life sucked out of you by illness because you were bad and you didn't cook for your man and didn't pray. In this movie, you get the life sucked out of you because you crossed the phantom sound wave and you got in Jonathan Rhys Meyers' way.
Freedom Land.
Whatever.
I couldn't remember the name of that stupid movie.
It's an idiotic film, Six Souls. You should watch it. Because it's real stupid. And I laughed and laughed. So, yeah. One thumb up that movie's butt.
I missed it. I don't know that I feel bad that I missed
You're not going to. You don't have to see it.
Okay.
But everyone listening has to go see it.
I see.
Or watch it on demand. Waste your money. Really.
Throw it into the street.
You'll feel good about that.
All right, let's do some letters. We got to wrap up.
Yeah. Letters. We got the things and the stuff. Okay, this is from Carol Ann.
Go into the light.
How many times do you think people say that?
Oh, God, I bet, yeah. Isn't there, there's a Carol Ann in Mommy Dearest, too, isn't there? Like in The Assistant or something?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Hi, Dave White and Alonzo.
So.
This is a letter to me.
Clearly.
She don't even know your last name. This is my fan.
Go on.
I was introduced to your podcast by my husband, whose name is Dave, who is a huge Dave White fan.
That's great.
You could just go, you could go to the bathroom or something and wash your hands since this letter is clearly not for you.
Indeed, yes. Do go on.
I do remember hearing Alonzo on Malcolm Ingram's old podcast, Blowhard. But can't remember if y'all had a podcast then and why I did not start listening to it. Silly me, I guess. What really got me into listening religiously was the fact that I currently have very little time to watch movies and tons of time to listen to podcasts. I work full-time and commute 4 times a week, 70 miles, to take care of my 96-year-old grandmother.
Wow.
Dude, I know what that's like. Although I never did commute 4 times a week, but I was back and forth to Texas all the time. I'm sorry, I'm reading this letter cold. She loves Dave White's voice because she can hear it. And it sounds like a movie star. That's right.
Tor Johnson.
That's exactly. Time for Tor. Oh, too bad. I do not have a top 2012 list because I have only seen 3 movies. Most of what I watch is on Netflix and are docs or indie films, which are hard to rate for me. My top 10 list of all time is diverse because I'm all over the place when it comes to what I like. Also, these are all movies I've seen about 100 times and can watch 100 more times. Number 1, Dogma.
Wow, okay. Yeah.
Just, she says, I'm a Kevin Smith fangirl since 14.
Wow.
Yeah. Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
God Bless America, which we both hate.
We're not crazy.
Yeah, we both hate that movie. But we still like you.
Yes.
Yeah. Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
My Fair Lady.
Okay.
My Fair Lady sucks.
It's not my favorite music. It has its moments. It's a great score, but...
Of all the movies, back in the 90s when I would meet my mom once a month at the North Park Mall and go see movies with her and go eat lunch and stuff. On a Saturday afternoon, I would invariably take her to something that she wound up hating. Like, we went to see the re-release of Vertigo, and she's like, he was a pervert. Alfred Hitchcock was a pervert. I was like, yeah, I know.
Well, yes, but...
But boy, did she like My Fair Lady. My mom loved My Fair Lady. I remember walking out of that going, because I had never seen it before. Mm. They re-released it in the 90s.
Right.
We walked out of that movie, and I go, that was work.
I think it's
and Danny. She goes, oh, I just loved it so much.
I think it was Danny Peary that said it's the kind of musical you leave humming the songs from other musicals.
Jiro or Euro Dreams of Sushi? I never
heard of Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Jiro, okay.
Which we still need to watch.
Yeah. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which we love. 28 Days Later, which is awesome. Yeah. A Mighty Wind, which is really funny. And Gosford Park, which we're totally into. So you get your 80% knife.
However, because you drive 4 times a week, 70 miles to take care of your 96-year-old grandmother,
you're 100% knife. You're 100% knife, exactly. Honorable mention, Rear Window, All About Eve, Shawshank, and then in parentheses, yes, I know. And she says she has a weird crush on Morgan Freeman. why not? Clerks 1 and 2.
Okay.
Yeah.
Clerks 2 starring Rosario Dawson.
Rosario Dawson. Next letter is from Travis Moose. Please let that be your real last name. I really need that to be your real last name. Hey guys, I've been a longtime fan and finally decided to share my top 10 list of movies with you. Hope you enjoy. Though not in any order, the first one is by far my favorite cinematic sin. Number one, The Ten Commandments.
Oh, Moses.
How could one not enjoy the steamy Egyptian temptress beckoning with her moist and supple lips? The original Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Dune. Children shouldn't play with dead things. Oh, this is so great.
Rosie Holitik.
He writes, hippies on an island with a bunch of zombies. Soul Survivor, a 1970 made-for-TV movie starring a young William Shatner. I've never heard of this movie.
Me neither. Well, he wasn't that young.
Well, yeah, but younger than he is now.
Sure.
Number six, The Other Sister. I agree with you. I agree with you that now, The Other Sister is so great.
Now you're just pulling our leg.
Other Sister is really amazing and stars my favorite Scientologist, Juliette Lewis.
Yes. I think my favorite Scientologist is now Elizabeth Moss.
She's number two.
Okay.
Juliette Lewis is OG cool Scientologist. Elizabeth Moss is the new breed of Scientology actor.
Right.
That we can get with. Yeah.
And don't forget Brandy after her stunning performance.
I don't forget Brandy.
Tyler Perry's Temptation.
I do not forget Brandy. Kentucky Fried Movie.
Yes.
Big Fish. Mm. Yeah, I didn't like Big Fish. Vegas in Space, which I have never seen. I'm thinking this person's gay.
I'm getting, just a hunch. Yeah.
And The Last Emperor, which I'm really into The Last Emperor.
I hated that movie.
Really loved The Last Emperor.
There was a period where, like, my family...
He says, they make it a point to order Chinese takeout when watching this movie.
Maybe one of those relatives is delivering it. My family, you know, we Spanish style, we did Christmas, the big Christmas dinner on Christmas Eve, and you know, go to midnight mass.
Right.
So Christmas Day was always a sort of afterthought. We're like, well, now what do we do? So more often than not, we would go to the movies. And there was a stretch there where we would go see, like, the big prestige Oscar movie opening that day, and they were such snoozers. It was, I remember, in a row in the 80s, it was The Last Emperor, Out of Africa, and Hoffa. And so I remember making it a point to go see Dumb and Dumber on Christmas Day because I had it with the Oscar movie.
No.
They were killing
me. Did you take anyone in your family to see Dumb and Dumber?
I think Rod, actually, yeah, it went with me and Kurt.
Well, he liked it.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Because you should have made everyone in your family go see Dumb and Dumber.
I tried.
No, we're not going to do that. We need to see something important.
Like, No.
Hoffa.
I think after Hoffa, we were all like, ugh, enough of this.
Okay, we gotta go.
Give him a knife.
Oh, yeah. How much knife does that get? Wait a second. Let me go back and scroll again. We're gonna give you Vegas in Space as a gimme because have you seen it?
I have. It's.
Is it bad?
It's not bad. It's just, it's well intentioned.
Big Fish, we don't like. Soul Survivor, we haven't seen. Dune, you don't like.
No.
All right, you're going to get 85 out of us.
That sounds fair.
Because we haven't seen the Shatner movie. I haven't seen Vegas in Space.
Do you like Dune? Dave White.
I kind of like Dune.
Okay. I got nothing.
I was going to say the last. I'm not going to say the last bit. The kid and the thing. No, forget it.
Surely he is the Quisatzetter. How can this be? I'm also not giving him The Last Emperor, but 85 sounds fine.
Whatever. 85.
Sure.
B.
Solid B. Yeah. So are we once again not reading the email from Korean superstar Cho Kong?
That is correct, because we have to run off to the world and get this kid an art scholarship.
Korean superstar Chil Kang, we promise we will read your letter next week. In fact, let's at the top of the show, we're going to start next week's program
with Chil's letter. With
Chil's letter. All right. It's an amazing Asian top 10 list.
Yes.
And who better than the Asianiest Asian we know? Korean superstar.
Is he the Asianiest?
He's the only one I know that watches like Korean telenovelas.
And cries.
Well, that's a whole other
heterosexual man who cries over
that's a whole other novellas. Kettle of kimchi. Thank you for listening, as always. We would love to point you to our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, who is doing pledge drive, but PBS or NPR could learn a thing or two about how to make a pledge drive fun by listening to the way that Throwing Shade does it, I will say. Team Jack, the schmoes. Oh, God, we have to text Jack. He wanted us to be on the show.
When?
Like this weekend. We need to talk to him.
This weekend?
Or early next week.
Oh, yeah. All right. You get on that.
I will.
You get on
that. The Schmoes Know, the B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this program for free on iTunes, and please leave us a review. We always appreciate those. You can stream the show at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com. Like our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show at GetGlue.com, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Send us your top 10 list, questions, complaints, comments, whatever you got. We'd love to hear from you. And we will catch you next time.
Goodbye.